Welcome to Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. This is Manuel Criollo with my co-host Damon Azali. Joining us today will be Jennifer Gonerman, who is staff writer at The Village Voice and author of Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Barlett, which is available in paperback in bookstores this week. We'll be talking to her about the recent changes in the Rockefeller drug laws in New York and her new book. And for our second segment, we'll be speaking with Roberto Elizalde, live from Montevideo, Uruguay. We'll be speaking to him about the recent electoral victory of the Frente Amplio, the opportunities and the challenges. The axis of good is growing, y'all, and we got to be, you know, keeping up with this stuff. And we'll be right back really soon with Jennifer Gonerman. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines, 4 o'clock hour on KPFK, 90.7 Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. Right now on the line, we have Jennifer Gonerman, who is a staff writer at The Village Voice and has done a lot of really incredible work in terms of bringing the struggle against the prison system, against mass incarceration of folks to light. She's also an author of Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Barlett. And we're going to talk a little bit more about her story a little bit in the interview. People should go by and check out this book. It just came out on paperback this week, and it's a really interesting one. So, Jennifer, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being here. So why don't we just start a little bit around the Rockefeller drug laws. There was some changes and some motion in this last couple of weeks around them. And maybe if you can just maybe start with the history of them and then tell us how they've kind of changed.
Sure. The Rockefeller drug laws were created in 1973 by New York's then Governor Nelson Rockefeller. And they're interesting for many reasons. They essentially launched the nation's war on drugs by creating the first state mandatory minimum drug sentences. And over the next few decades, virtually every state and the federal government copied this experiment by passing their own mandatory minimum drug sentences. New York's were always among the toughest. And for 31 years, they essentially remained unchanged. There have been some very minor changes early on, but for the most part, it had remained unchanged for more than three decades. And then just last week, the state legislators did make some changes to the drug laws. It was front page news here in New York State. The changes weren't huge. The drug laws are still mandatory, but they did take care of some of the greatest injustices by decreasing the amount of time people spend for some of the most severe and serious crimes.
And a lot of the things that I've read, they have, you know, Category A felonies, Category B. And what were the actual changes in the actual law?
Well, the most severe penalties affected people who were convicted of what's called A-level felonies, an A1 felony. It's the highest level felony. In New York State, if you are convicted of selling at least 2 ounces or possessing at least 4 ounces of heroin or cocaine, that is considered an A1 felony. And it was punishable by at least 15 years to life in prison. And that was a mandatory sentence.
And that's the first offense.
Yeah, and it didn't matter if it was your first offense or your 10th offense. It didn't matter if you were a drug mule, if you were an addict, if you were a kingpin. Everybody got at least 15 years to life. And because the laws were mandatory, there was really no flexibility. The judges didn't really have the power to adjust the sentence for the defendant. Now, what happened last week is that they decreased those penalties. So instead of 15 to life, it's now 8 to 20 for people convicted of this level of crime. And they also increased the weight of the drugs involved. So instead of it being about selling at least 2 ounces and possessing at least 4 ounces, it's now the weights have been doubled. So that means obviously fewer people will be doing, you know, such extremely long sentences.
Right. And so from what I was reading, and always this is through the lens of who was writing the history, the Rockefeller drug laws were supposed to go after the quote-unquote kingpins that were selling drugs in our communities. And what it seems like it's actually happened is that the folks in the communities who are trying to make extra money out of economic need are actually carrying drugs or whatnot, and they're the ones who are actually getting hit with this.
Exactly. I mean, you know, a lot of people who are kingpins, obviously sophisticated enough to know that if they are caught with the drugs on them, they're the ones who are going to be doing the serious time. So they'll have a less informed person, an addict, a poor person, somebody who doesn't really know what's going on, carry the weight for them, and then obviously if they get caught, they're the ones who are going to be getting the stiffest penalties.
Right. So in your opinion, was in the originally of actually writing the law, was it actually trying to actually stop the drug kingpins, or was it also like a lot of laws that we have now, kind of like racially class motivated in terms of who they were going to get caught up in the system?
I think that there were many different factors at play. I mean, back in 1973, heroin was a huge problem in inner city New York City, as it was in other urban areas, but particularly in New York. So there was a serious drug problem. They had tried a number of different things to stamp it out. A lot of money had been invested in different treatment programs, and it didn't really seem to be fixing the problem. But at the same time, we had a governor who was looking towards the White House. Nelson Rockefeller was a fairly liberal Republican. He needed to shore up his conservative credentials, though, if he ever hoped of getting the Republican nomination. So I think that was also sort of fueling his desire to really look tough on crime. And you know, you mentioned all the sort of obvious racial and class implications. In New York State, at least 94% of the people locked up under the drug laws are African American or Latino. So they've had a sort of devastating effect on a handful of inner city communities in New York City. I don't know, you know, I wouldn't want to say that was the intention of the laws, but it's certainly been the effect.
So in terms of actually the movement that has actually, and I think it's, I read it was 16 years that people have been trying to fight this?
Well, people have actually been trying to fight the laws since before they were even signed.
Right.
I mean, the minute they were proposed, there were people in all sorts of communities complaining that it was going to, you know, disproportionately affect them, who are sort of ringing the alarm bells about the possible, you know, human cost of these drug laws and financial cost. But there's been a more sort of concerted effort in the last 7 years. With different family members and ex-prisoners and current prisoners trying to speak out and gain some media attention and some traction. I think their activism efforts have finally paid off or begun to pay off.
So then just stepping off of that, what does it look like in terms of New York, in terms of the legislature, the forces that are both actually pushing for stuff and then the people who are fighting against it? I know there's stuff around the Working Families Party, et cetera. And just as a kind of a side note, in California, a lot of the way the prison system works is because the prison guards are a really, really strong lobby and put tons of money into the legislature, both Democrat and Republican, to get harsher sentences around, you know, around three strikes, et cetera, et cetera. So, again, just trying to see, is there similarities around there? And just more of kind of like, what does the terrain look like around this issue?
Different from California, but we do have a state corrections officers union, of course, but it's not nearly as politically savvy or powerful or well-financed as the one in California. I mean, the people that are... not yet, anyway. But the people who are most opposed to change in these areas are the state's prosecutors. Mm-hmm. The drug laws here for so long have been a really powerful force in helping prosecutors do their job. For example, if somebody gets arrested with a fair amount of drugs and they're looking at a really long sentence, say 15 years to life, they become suddenly very eager to make a deal with the prosecutors to plead down to a lower crime and end up doing less time. And so the vast majority of people, you know, nearly 100% of people plead guilty rather than go to trial because they're terrified of getting these mandatory minimum drug sentences. And it kind of moves the system along more quickly. Prosecutors don't actually have to try cases, which is incredibly time-consuming and expensive. So they've become a real weapon used by prosecutors to do their jobs and one that they have been loath to give up. And so they're the ones who have been the sort of most fierce opponents of any kind of real reform or change. What's happened in recent months, though, is that there's 62 counties in New York State, so 62 district attorneys, and in recent months, a few of the most visible ones had actually spoken out in favor of reform, and so that unity is beginning to be chipped away, and I think that's part of the reason why reform has been possible in last week.
And so in terms of the politicians, are they the doing similar things of kind of riding the wave of being tough on crime, super predators, et cetera, et cetera?
I mean, they certainly have been for decades, you know, in New York as they have in California and everywhere else. You know, it seemed like after Nelson Rockefeller put the Rockefeller drug laws into effect, they essentially sent this national message letting all politicians know that tough on crime works, that currying favor with voters as possible through fear. If you scare voters enough and then come out with some incredibly punitive policies, that they will sort of be in your palm and certainly a way to sort of curry political favor. Mm-hmm. I think what's happened in New York and in other states across the country in recent years is they've kind of woken up to the reality of this practice. I mean, it's incredibly expensive. So many states cannot afford any longer to have their prison systems growing at the rate at which they've been growing. And in New York State, I think they're finally just beginning to realize that the political winds are shifting. I mean, more than half the states in the country have reformed their mandatory minimum drug laws in recent years, and I think New York is finally beginning to come around.
Yeah, that's real interesting just in terms of kind of the long-term kind of effects of this stuff. When I was thinking about, more in terms of the... Okay, let me back up. What are the forces that are actually fighting for the kind of reform? Are there particular organizations that are doing stuff? Is it mostly just kind of families of prisoners that are?
There's lots of organizations, most of which are in New York City, and there's organizations that have been fighting for decades. In the past, what they usually did to fight was, they wrote reports, they wrote op-eds for the newspaper, they tried to get media, they promoted, publicized different statistics. But what's happened in recent years, it kind of changed the terrain and I think infused the anti-drug law movement with some new momentum, is that people who have been personally affected have started to have a voice in the movement, a voice in the public debate. What I mean is people who are locked up with 15 to life or 20 to life sentences and their family members have become front and center in the movement to change the drug laws. And obviously their voices in this are very powerful. And I think it's because they have begun to advocate on behalf of themselves, and the fact that they have been getting a tremendous amount of media attention, a whole bunch of different families, I think has gone a long way towards swaying public opinion.
And one of your articles you wrote in the Village Voice on November 16th, you talked about how Connecticut had a huge budget. It was $500 million budget deficit and had more prisoners than they can house. A lot of times how I've heard this stuff about releasing prisoners or criminal justice reform has been about the budget and, we don't have as much money to pay for it. So I think I would like to hear you go into a little bit around the Million Dollar Blocks article. But then within that, thinking about a lot of times if that is just the demand and it's not about, 94% of people in New York that are in prison are Black and Latino. When you have a situation like New York, when the prison population is actually dropping, then you kind of lose the force of that demand.
That's certainly true. I mean, just like in California and New York, people have used all kinds of arguments to try to defeat the sort of prison expansion, from the moral argument to the financial argument and so forth and so on.
And which ones have you seen to have worked the best?
I just think nationally the economic argument has been in a lot of ways the most successful. I mean, it's when, as you mentioned, legislators are facing serious budget shortfalls that they're most willing to think creatively about making changes. They're most willing to take those risks that politicians need to take in order to decrease their prison population, which isn't to say one shouldn't also make a lot of moral arguments. But it just seems to be, in recent years, sort of to have the most influence. What's happened in New York is actually a lot of people have been speculating all week about what motivated legislators to finally make some changes. And while there isn't the same sorts of budget shortfalls in New York right now, I think there's more a sort of sense of self-interest. What started to happen is that some of the Republicans have been threatened in their reelections in ways that they hadn't in the past, incumbent Republican state legislators, and the drug law issue is increasingly becoming an issue in these sorts of local races. And so I think as sort of conservative Republicans start to feel that their own sort of self-preservation, their own odds of being reelected are affected by their position on this issue, they become increasingly willing to look at it from the other side and seriously think about reform and change.
Because it brings kind of into mind the recent presidential election where, until the last 2 weeks, the Democrat that's supposed to be more, in terms of the base, his base is supposed to be more in the kind of Black folks of color community, okay. And didn't really talk about it. And I think that's, just in my opinion, I think that's one of the reasons why more black folks and whatnot don't actually come out to vote for some of these people because they're not, they're kind of walking around the issue as opposed to indirectly. So I feel like the economic argument is a good one, and I think it should be a multi-sided one, but I think the one that will get folks actually thinking about it and saying, hey, this is not okay that 64% of the people locked up in for three strikes in California are black. Like, that's just not okay. And unless we, you know, folks start talking about it, you know, should be talking to the politicians right now, but unless the Democrats in particular, but then also the Republicans start talking about that, I feel like the debate is just going to be locked kind of in a room, and it's not going to get out to a lot of folks.
Yeah, it's probably the best and most effective way to sort of challenge all these assumptions is just to hit them, you know, from every angle. So you're combining all sorts of arguments, mm-hmm. environmental in addition to economic and moral and every other possible argument one can think of to sort of challenge some of the things that are going on in California and over here in New York.
So let's get into the book, because I actually haven't read the book yet. I'm very excited to do it, but I read interview with you and Elaine, who were on Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and folks can very easily get that off at democracynow.org. So maybe we can just start about just telling us how the book came about. Actually, before that, why don't you tell people where they can get the book, if there's a website or whatnot?
Yeah, certainly. The book is called Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. It came out earlier this year in March. It just came out in paperback within the last week. We've got a website that tells you all about the book. It's the same as the title, lifeontheoutside.com is the website. And it's available in sort of a lot of major bookstores, independent bookstores everywhere. And you can, of course, buy it on the web.
Okay. So then why don't you tell us, how did you come to, did you just all of a sudden say, hey, I want to write this book? Or, like, what's the history in terms of you meeting Elaine and then moving on, helping with the book?
I met Elaine Bartlett in 1998. At that time, she was in year 14 of a 20-to-life sentence in a maximum security prison in New York State for women. It's called Bedford Hills Prison. She had been sentenced to 20-to-life under the Rockefeller drug laws. Her crime was carrying 4 ounces of cocaine from Harlem up to Albany, the state capital, and handing it over to an undercover state trooper. A friend had set up this deal telling her she would make $2,500 if she delivered the drugs. Obviously, she didn't know she was delivering them to a cop. At the time, she had 4 kids all under the age of 10 when she went into prison. And when I met her that day, you know, at that point, she had gone in when she was 26, and so at the point that I met her, she was about 42. And I just couldn't believe that there was a woman with such an unbelievable story just sitting in a prison about 30 or 35 miles north of Manhattan. In the year 1998, just seemed astonishing. Here she was. She was a first-time offender with a 20-to-life sentence, and you know, she's sitting there in the visiting room telling me how completely decimated her family is, of course, by the fact that she's been gone for so long. I ended up doing a long story about her for The Village Voice, and then turns into a book, and the book came out earlier this year.
Okay. So you're listening to KPFK 90.7 in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara. And we are speaking with Jennifer Gonerman, who's a staff writer at The Village Voice and is the author of Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. So in the interview that I heard on Democracy Now!, you basically talked a little bit about how incarceration, how the prison system affected not only Elaine, but then also when she came back to her family, what happened there, how she couldn't organize against the housing department, et cetera. So maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Certainly. The book, while you and I have been talking about the Rockefeller drug laws and Elaine was locked up under them, the bulk of the book is really about what happens after her release from prison. So she walked out of prison January 26, 2000. That's actually the opening scene of the book. She declares the happiest day of her life. She got out of prison after 16 years. She didn't have to do the full 20 years because she got clemency from New York's governor, George Pataki. And so she got all dressed up in a purple pantsuit and black leather high-heel boots and a black long trench coat and comes sort of dancing out of the prison early in the morning in this day, a very snowy day in January. And she was absolutely ecstatic, and because she'd gotten clemency, she became a little bit of a mini celebrity in New York, and there were television cameras there, reporters interviewing. Right, it's sort of like winning the lotto. At that point, right. Winning the lotto for a prisoner, at that point there were 70,000 people in New York prisons,
wow.
And only three a year or three or four a year were getting clemency. At any rate, I stayed in touch with her, and she moved to the Lower East Side of Manhattan into an apartment with her children, who were now all grown. And I stayed in touch over the next days and weeks, and I assumed that, you know, this was kind of the happy ending to a really sad and tragic story. And in fact, I was in many ways completely wrong. She started saying things to me like, I left one prison to come home to another, which is a pretty intense thing, you know, for somebody to be saying just, you know, 48 hours after they left prison. She moved home to a very overcrowded and decrepit apartment. She found her family in complete shambles. When she had gone to prison, her mother had raised her children. So the grandmother had raised the four grandchildren, and now the grandmother had passed away, and so all the children were sort of lost and depressed, and one of them was actually locked up in prison also on another drug case. And like all people coming out of prison, she had sort of tremendous obstacles confronting her. So the book follows her as she tries to find a job, as she tries to find a new home and a place to live, as she tries to find a wardrobe, as she tries to get money. She left prison with only $40 and, of course, ran through that within a day. So it just details the tremendous hurdles that she was up against and which confront, you know, all of the sort of 650,000-plus people a year who come out of prison.
And this is not like a special case. Like this basically happens to all these people who come out, and some of them. I mean, it sounded like she still had a bit of a support network.
She had a little bit of a support network. I mean, she had been gone for so long. She'd been gone for more than 16 years that, you know, she no longer was in touch with the friends she'd had before she went in, and her mother had passed away. So she had her children. But they weren't necessarily in a position to support her financially and not really emotionally much. She had a few people she'd met while she'd been locked up who were on the outside. There was somebody who helped her win clemency who became a close friend. But like a lot of people, she sort of had to rebuild and try to rejoin society, and she struggled to rejoin her family. And there was sort of tremendous hurdles, you know, everything from strict parole officers who have very numerous rules, including sort of a 9 p.m. curfew, to all the tensions in her household with her daughters, who were angry at her for having abandoned them when they were just babies. So the problems were, you know, almost insurmountable what she was up against.
Right. So let's say the name of the book again, and let's tell people how to get it.
Sure. It's Life on the Outside, The Prison Odyssey of Elaine Bartlett. It's been published in paperback by Picador. You can check it out on the book's website, which is www.lifeontheoutside.com, and it's available in bookstores everywhere.
Cool. So I think the last thing I wanted to talk to you about, Jennifer, we were speaking to Jennifer Goderman, who is a staff writer for Village Voice, is the recent article you had around the Million Dollar Blocks, which talked about how there are certain actually sections where there's a concentration, like a particular block, where there maybe say five people who were actually locked up. Actually, why don't you wrote an article about it. Why don't you tell us about it?
Certainly. The article was called Million Dollar Blocks, and it focused on a phenomenon in New York City, but it's a phenomenon that's been taking place in cities across the country, so it's certainly not particular to New York. Essentially what it is, it's just a different way of looking at our incarceration boom. So instead of looking at the prison population numbers, it involves looking at a sort of map of a city. So, for example, in the Village Voice, we published a map of Brooklyn, and each neighborhood was color-coded. And the million-dollar blocks were coded dark red. Now, by million-dollar block, I mean that on those particular blocks, last year, so many people were locked up that the eventual price tag for their incarceration will exceed $1 million. And there were dozens of million-dollar blocks last year in Brooklyn, and there are million-dollar blocks in other cities across the country. Essentially, what these maps show very quickly is the incarceration of, the concentration of people end up going to prison. So if you look at any map of a city, you'll see that there's just really a handful of neighborhoods that are the primary feeders for the prison system, and they tend, not surprisingly, to be the poorest neighborhoods in any given city. And also what these maps illustrate is the kind of, you know, not just the concentrations of the people who go to prison, but people who come out of prison tend to return to the neighborhoods that they left. So you have people coming out of prison who are obviously very needy and broke, returning to the poorest neighborhoods in the community, returning to familiar streets. And so Million Dollar Blocks, the concept of them, the maps of them, became sort of another way to think about the incarceration boom and its impacts on individual city neighborhoods.
Right, and folks that actually can still check out the article. It's on, if you go to www.villagevoice.com, and then you look up Jennifer's name, G-O-N-N-E-R-M-A-N, you can see the report. One of the things I just wanted to read out of it, it talks about basically 60% of the prisoners came from New York City, but virtually every prison is located upstate in places like Attica, Malone, et cetera. And you quote Todd Clare, who's a professor at John Jay College. He says, basically, people who live in Park Avenue give a lot of money to people who live in Auburn, New York, in order to watch people who live in Brooklyn for a couple of years and then send them back damaged. So I think this is, I think in terms of reading the article, it just very much hit home that basically that people, particular communities, are still being attacked and that it's still, you know, part of the historical kind of racism that kind of goes on. I guess the last minute we got, I wanted to ask you, what do you hear as the next steps in terms of continuing to push on criminal justice reform or the Rockefeller drug law reform for the folks out in New York?
I think that, you know, it's not really clear here yet whether our reform measures that were announced last week, whether it's kind of a one-stop or one-time event, or whether it's just the beginning of chipping away at mandatory minimum sentencing in New York State. But I really think that the latter is possible. I think that as the voices of people that are personally affected, as these first-person stories get more and more attention, I think that sort of public support for such punitive measures is going to begin to erode more and more. I mean, that's certainly what Life on the Outside begins to do, I think, which is to illustrate the human cost, you know, the human effects, or the effects on an individual family of having the mom locked up for so many years. And I think when the public comes sort of face-to-face with some of these human costs, not just the numbers, not just the dollars, but the real sort of impact on individual lives, on children's lives, I think it becomes harder and harder to make a rationale for having such incredibly long sentences.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Jennifer, for being on the show, and thank you so much for your writing that actually is putting these issues out so people can actually understand and who aren't necessarily affected by it. So, again, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Okay. So we'll be right back after this short break.